listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Our special guest, of course, is T.C. Boyle, and he is the trickster figure of American letters. Part court jester, part holy fool, he slips in and out of various narrative disguises as it suits him, and this is clearly evident in his latest collections of stories, Wild Child. Mr. Boyle is also the author of 11 novels, including World's End, which won the 1987 Penn Faulkner Award. The Tortilla Curtain, which has now sold over 400,000 copies in paperback, and Drop City, a New York Times bestseller and a finalist for the National Book Award. He has published 8 collections of stories and was the recipient of the prestigious Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in the Short Story. His stories appear regularly in The New Yorker, GQ, Esquire, McSweeney's, and Playboy. He lives in Santa Barbara in the George C. Stewart House, the first private residence of Frank Lloyd Wright, built in California. Inspired by his home, Mr. Boyle's latest novel, The Women, examines Wright's notorious, tumultuous relationships with 4 women. Will you welcome T.C. Boyle?
Well, hello, folks. Thanks for turning out on a rainy night. As you can see, I've experienced a sartorial revolution recently. I was musing about Tom Wolfe, and he always wears a white suit. But he's a Southern gentleman, and that befits a Southern gentleman. I, however, am not a Southern gentleman, and so here is the revolution. I love this room. I was here once before. I think I was either the first to inaugurate this room or one of the very first, and I remember how intimate and great it is. My one question tonight, though, is why am I way back here? I want to be up there. But this is where it's mic'd, and so we'll do our best. As Joyce told you, I'm just kicking off a book tour here in support of The Women, which just came out in paperback, and the new collection, Wild Child. Last night, I performed at Victoria Hall in Santa Barbara, and I didn't have to get on an airplane to get there. And today, I'm here, and again, no airplanes. However, at the grim hour of 6:45 tomorrow morning, I will be trying to get on that flight to New York. And I am always, always selected to be stripped naked and beaten with the rubber hoses in the back room. And I'm very resentful about this. The part of this I love is to entertain you. I love to read stories aloud. It's something that I first had from my mother, of course. I was a sort of a hyperactive child, if you can imagine. But we didn't have Ritalin back then. We had a back door, and that's how I survived. But I didn't learn to read quickly, and my mother read to me, and I've always loved to hear stories aloud. And then I reflected on it over the years as to why I enjoy doing this so much. And we had an eighth grade teacher named Donald Grant, Mr. Grant. He was very severe, but he was also an amateur actor. And if we were good, and yeah, we were pretty good, on Fridays he would read us a story, but dramatically. And, you know, things like The Most Dangerous Game, Edgar Allan Poe stories. And I look back on it, and I think that is part of what inspired my love of reading aloud. There's nothing quite like it. I had done some of my books for Books on Tape early on, but you know, it takes a lot of time in the studio, and I stopped doing them until a few years ago. By the way, I'm a huge fan of Books on Tape because I have to drive down the Coast Highway to get to USC. It used to be twice a week, now it's once a week. And I'm the guy in the red sports car doing 85 on your bumper. I'm sorry, but you know, I'm very expeditious. The governor should give me an award. I'm moving traffic. Anyway, I'm addicted to books on tape. I really love them. And a couple of years ago, my wife and I were coming down, and we were listening to a book by Carol Shields called Larry's Party, and she read it herself beautifully, absolutely stunning. And I realized about halfway through that this is Carol speaking to us from the grave. I mean, she had died in the interval. And I'm feeling great. I'm really feeling great, folks. But I felt, boy, I better start doing some more of these. So I did not do the women, but I did the last two books that preceded it, and I've also done this book for Blackstone Audio, and I really do enjoy it. It's very strange. To be here before you and to perform a story is pretty thrilling. Here you are, you know. And by the way, have I expressed how beautiful you are physically? God, I've never seen a better-looking audience. But it's so strange to be in the studio doing it because you're performing for nobody, for a producer sitting kitty-corner to you outside a little window. It's so odd to do. But still, I've done it, and I guess I've enjoyed it as much as I can. Tonight, they've asked me to keep it fairly short. Normally, I would go on for 6 hours. I was going to read you at least half of the women, but they want me to keep it short. So what we'll do tonight is I would like to give you a story from the new book, and then we'll do some Q&A, and maybe I can even kind of move out there into the front of the stage, you know, where I'd be more comfortable. Let's see, what can I say about stories? I began as a story writer. In fact, I went to the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop and stayed on there to get my PhD in 19th century British Lit. And I had three teachers there, Vance Bourgeli and his former pupil, John Irving, and then John Cheever. And in the interval, I also met and became friendly with Raymond Carver. I hadn't written a novel, but I'd probably published 30 stories. And I had a book of stories ready, my first book, Descent of Man. And I had been speaking with John Irving, and I said, you know, I don't think I want to be a novelist. I think I just want to be like Ray or John, who is mainly a story writer, and just write stories. And he said, well, you know, you might change your mind. And as soon as I finished the PhD, I began Water Music, this enormous, ambitious, 500-page, crazy novel, and I've been at it ever since. But I still love the short story form, and this is my ninth book of stories. I hope always to be writing them. In fact, I've just finished a new novel called When the Killing's Done, and it is set on our Channel Islands off of Santa Barbara. By the way, going up and down the coast, I thought, gee, well, I wonder what those islands are all about. What goes on out there? Now I know. And I'm going to tell you in March of next year. But I finished that book and delivered it in July, and since I've been writing stories, some of you may be aware that I had a story in Harper's, My Pain is Worse Than Your Pain, is the title. Just this month, and also last week in The New Yorker, a new story called The Death in Kitchewank. So I'm in a short story phase right now and really enjoying it, but I can see the next novel on the horizon coming up before too long. So all that aside, I would like to present to you a story from the new book called The Lie. I'd used up all my sick days and the two personal days they allowed us. But when the alarm went off and the baby started squalling and my wife threw back the covers to totter off to the bathroom in a hobbled two-legged trot, I knew I wasn't going into work. It was as if a black shroud had been pulled over my face. My eyes were open, but I couldn't see. Or no, I could see. The pulsing LED display on the clock radio, the mounds of laundry and discarded clothes humped around the room like the tumuli of the dead, a hard-driving rain drooling down the dark vacancy of the window. But everything seemed to have a film over it, a world coated in Vaseline. The baby let out a series of scaled-back cries. The toilet flushed. The overhead light flicked on. Clover was back in the room, the baby flung over one shoulder. She was wearing an old cramps T-shirt she liked to sleep in and nothing else. I might have found this sexy to one degree or another, but for the fact that I wasn't at my best in the morning, and I'd seen her naked, save for one rock and roll memento T-shirt, for something like 1,000 consecutive mornings now. It's 6:15, she said. I said nothing. My eyes eased shut. I heard her at the closet, and in the dream that crashed down on me in that instant, She metamorphosed from a rippling human female with a baby slung over one shoulder to a great shining bird springing from the brink of a precipice and sailing on great shining wings into the void. I woke to the baby, on the bed, beside me. "You change her," my wife said. "You feed her. I'm late as it is." We'd had some people over the night before, friends from the pre-baby days, and we'd made margaritas in the blender, watched a movie, and stayed up late talking about nothing and everything. Clover had shown off the baby, Xana. We'd named her Xana after a character in one of the movies I'd edited, or actually logged, and I'd felt a rush of pride. Here was this baby, perfect in every way, beautiful because her parents were beautiful, and that was all right. Tank, he'd been in my band, co-leader, co-founder, and we'd written songs together till that went sour. Said she was fat enough to eat, and I'd said, "Yeah, just let me fire up the Barbie." And Clover had given me her little drawn-down pout of disgust because I was being juvenile. We stayed up till the rain started. I poured one more round of margaritas, and then Tank's girlfriend opened her maw in a yawn that could have sucked in the whole condo and the street out front, too, and the party broke up. Now I was in bed, and the baby was crawling up my right leg, giving off a powerful reek of shit. The clock inched forward. Clover got dressed, put on her makeup, and took her coffee mug out to the car and was gone. There was nothing heroic in what I did next, dealing with the baby and my own car and the stalled nose-to-tail traffic that made the 3 miles to the babysitter's seem like a trek across the wastelands of the earth. It was just life, that was all. But as soon as I handed Xana over to Violetta at the door of her apartment that threw up a wall of cooking smells, tearful Telemundo dialogue, and the diachronic yapping of her 4 chihuahuas, I slammed myself into the car and called in sick. Or no, not sick. My sick days were gone, I reminded myself. And my personal days, too. My boss picked up the phone. "Iron House Productions," he said, his voice digging out from under the R's. He had trouble with ours. He had trouble with English, for that matter. "Hello, Radko?" "Yes, it is he." "Who is it now?" "It's me, Lonnie." "Let me guess. You are sick." Radko was one of that select group of hard chargers in the production business who kept morning hours. And that was good for me, because with Clover working days and going to law school at night, and the baby, of course, my own availability was restricted to the daylight hours when Violetta's own children were at school and her husband at work operating one of the cranes that lifted the beams to build the city out till there was nothing green left for 50 miles around. But Radko had promised me career advancement, moving up from logging footage to actual editing. And that hadn't happened. On this particular morning, as on too many mornings in the past, I felt I just couldn't face the editing bay. The computer screen, the eternal idiocy of the dialogue repeated over and over through take after take, frame after frame. "No, Jim, stop. No, Jim, stop. No, Jim, stop." I used to be in a band. I had a college degree. I was no drudge. Before I could think, it was out. "It's the baby," I said. There was a silence I might have read too much into. Then Radko, dicing the interrogative, said, "What baby?" "Mine, my baby. Remember the pictures Clover emailed everybody?" My brain was doing cartwheels. "9 months ago, when she was born?" Another long pause. Finally, he said, "Yes." "Well, she's sick. She's very sick with a fever and all that. We don't know what's wrong with her." The wheel of internal calculus spun one more time, and I made another leap, the one that would prove to be fatal. "I'm at the hospital now." As soon as I hung up, I felt as if I'd been pumped full of helium, giddy with it, rising right out of my seat. But then the slow seepage of guilt, dread, and fear started in, drip by drip, like bile drained out of a liver gone bad. A delivery truck pulled up next to me. Rain beat at the windshield. 2 cholos rolled out of the apartment next to Violetta's. The green block tattoos they wore like collars glistening in the light trapped beneath the clouds. I had the whole day in front of me. I could do anything, go anywhere. An hour ago, it was sleep I wanted. Now it was something else. A pulse of excitement, the promise of illicit thrills, started up in my stomach. I drove down Ventura Boulevard in the opposite direction from the bulk of the commuters. They were stalled at the lights, a single driver in every car, the cars themselves like steel shells they'd extruded to contain their resentments. They were going to work. I wasn't. After a mile or so, I came to a diner where I sometimes took Clover for breakfast on Sundays, especially if we'd been out the night before. And on an impulse, I pulled into the lot. I bought a newspaper from the machine out front, and then I took a copy of the free paper, too, and went on in and settled into a seat by the window. The smell of fresh coffee and home fries made me realize how hungry I was, and I ordered the kind of breakfast I used to have in college after a night of excess. Salt, sugar, and grease in quantity, just to open my pores. While I ate, I made my way through both newspapers, item by item, because this was luxurious, kingly. The tables clean, the place brightly lit and warm to the point of steaming with the bustle of the waitresses and the rain at the windows like a plague. Nobody said a word to me. Nobody even looked at me but for my waitress. She was middle-aged, wedded to her uniform, her hair dyed shoe polish black. "More coffee?" she asked for the third or fourth time. No hurry, no rush, just an invitation. I glanced at my watch and couldn't believe it was only 9:30. That was the thing about taking a day off, the way the time reconfigured itself, and how you couldn't really help comparing any given moment with what you'd be doing at work. At work, I wouldn't have eaten yet, wouldn't have even reached the coffee break. "Jim, stop! No, no!" And my eyelids would have weighed 100 tons each. I thought about driving down to the ocean to see what the surf looked like under the pressure of the storm. Not that I was thinking about surfing. I hadn't been surfing more than a handful of times since the baby was born. It was just that the day was mine, and I wanted to fill it. I wound my way down through Topanga Canyon, the commuter traffic dissipated by now, and I saw how the creek was tearing at the banks, and there were two or three places where there was water on the road, and the soft red dough of the mud was like something that had come out of a mold. There was nobody on the beach but me. I walked along the shore till the brim of my baseball cap was sodden, and the legs of my jeans as heavy as if they'd just come out of the washing machine. I drove back up the canyon, the rain a little worse, the flooding more obvious and intense, but it wasn't anything really. Not like when the road washes out and you could be driving 1 minute and the next flailing for your life in a chute full of piss-yellow water. There was a movie at 2 I was interested in, but since it was just past 12 and I couldn't even think about lunch after the lumberjack special I'd had for breakfast, I went back to the condo, parked the car, and walked down the street, getting wetter and wetter and enjoying every minute of it, to a bar I knew. The door swung open on a denseness of purpose. 8 or 9 losers lined up on their bar stools, the smell of cut lime and the sunshine of the rum, a straight shot of Lysol from the toilet and back. It was warm, dark. A college basketball game hovered on the screen above the cash register. "A beer," I said, and then clarified by specifying the brand. I didn't get drunk. That would have been usual, and I didn't want to be usual. But I did have 3 beers before I went to the movie, and after the movie, I felt a vacancy in my lower reaches where lunch should have been. And so I stopped at a fast food place on my way to pick up the baby. They got my order wrong. The employees were glassy-eyed. The manager was nowhere to be found. And I was 35 minutes late for the baby. Still, I'd had my day. And when I got home, I fed the baby her cream of wheat, opened a beer, put on some music, and began chopping garlic and dicing onions with the notion of concocting a marinara sauce for my wife when she got home. Thoughts of the following morning, of Radko and what he might think or expect, never entered my mind. Not yet. All was well. The baby in her crib batting at the little figurines in the mobile above her head. The figurines, personally welded to the wires by Clover's hippie mother so that there wasn't even the faintest possibility the baby could get them lodged in her throat. The sauce bubbling on the stove, the rain tapping at the windows. I heard Clover's key in the door. And there she was, with her hair kinked from the rain and smelling like everything I'd ever wanted. And she was asking me how my day had gone. And I said, "Fine, just fine." Then it was morning again, and the same scene played itself out. Clover stutter-stepping to the bathroom, the baby mewling, rain whispering under the soundtrack. And I began to calculate all over again. It was Thursday. 2 more days to the weekend. If I could make it to the weekend, I was sure that by Monday at the latest, whatever was wrong with me, this feeling of anger, hopelessness, turmoil, whatever it was, would be gone. Just a break. I just needed a break, that was all. And Radko. The thought of facing him, of the way he would mold the drooping dog-like folds of his Slavic flesh around the suspicion in his eyes while he told me he was docking me a day's pay and expecting me to work overtime to make up for yesterday, was too much to hold on to. Not in bed. Not now. But then the toilet flushed, the baby squalled, and the overhead light went on. It's 6:15, my wife informed me. The evening before, after we dined on my marinara sauce with porcini mushrooms and Italian-style turkey sausage over penne pasta, in the interval, before she put the baby down for the night while the dishwasher murmured from the kitchen and we lingered over a second glass of Chianti, she told me she was thinking of changing her name. "What do you mean?" I was more surprised than angry, but I felt the anger come up in me all the same. "My name's not good enough for you? Like it was my idea to get married in the first place?" She had the baby in her lap. The baby was in high spirits, grinning her toothless baby grin and snatching for the wine glass my wife held just out of reach. "You don't have to get nasty about it. It's not your name that's the problem. It's mine, my first name." "What's wrong with Clover?" I said. And even as I said it, I knew how stupid I sounded. She was Clover. I could close my eyes, and she was Clover. Go to Africa and bury myself in mud, and she'd still be Clover. Fine. But the name was a hippie affectation of her hippie parents that were glassblowers with their own gallery. And it was insipid. I knew that, down deep. They might as well have named her Dandelion or Fescue. I was thinking of changing it to Chloris. She was watching me, her eyes defiant and insecure at the same time. Legally? I saw her point. She was a legal secretary studying to be a lawyer, and Clover just wouldn't fly on a masthead. But I hated the name, hated the idea. "Sounds like something you clean the toilet with," I said. She shot me a look of hate. "With bleach in it," I said, "with real scrubbing power." But now, though I felt as if I'd been crucified and wanted only to sleep for a week, till Monday, just till Monday, I sat up before she could lift the baby from the crib and drop her on the bed, and in the next moment, I was in the bathroom myself, staring into the mirror. As soon as she left, I was going to call Radko. I would tell him the baby was worse, that we'd been in the hospital all night. And if he asked what was wrong, I wasn't going to equivocate, because equivocation, any kind of uncertainty, a tremor in the voice, a tonal shift, play acting, is the surest lie detector. Leukemia, that was what I was going to tell him. The baby has leukemia. This time I waited till I was settled into the booth in the diner and the waitress with the shoe polish hair had got done fussing over me, the light of recognition in her eyes and a maternal smile creasing her lips. I was a regular 2 days in a row before I called in. And when Radko answered, the deepest, consonant, battering pole of suspicion lodged somewhere between his glottis and adenoids, I just couldn't help myself. "The baby," I said, holding it a beat. "The baby passed." Another beat. The waitress poured. Radko breathed fumes through the receiver. "It was last night at 4 a.m. There was nothing they could do." "Passed?" His voice came back at me. "What is this past?" "The baby's dead," I said. "She died." And then, in my grief, I broke the connection. I spent the entire day at the movies. The first show was at 11, and I killed time pacing around the parking lot at the mall till they opened the doors, and then I was inside in the anonymous dark. Images flashed by on the screen. The sound was amplified to a killing roar. The smell of melted butter hung over everything. When the lights came up, I ducked into the men's room and then slipped into the next theater, and the next one after that. I emerged at 4:15, feeling shaky. I told myself I was hungry, that was all. But when I wandered into the food court and saw what they had arrayed there, from chapatis to corn dogs to twice-cooked bachaca pretzels and Szechuan eggplant and a sauce of liquid fire, I pushed through the door of a bar instead. It was one of those oversanitized, too bright, echoing spaces the mall designers, in their wisdom, stuck in the back of their plastic restaurants so that the average moron accompanying his wife on a shopping expedition wouldn't have to kill himself. There was a basketball game on one of the three TVs encircling the bar. The waitresses were teenagers. The bartender had acne. I was the only customer. And I knew I had to pick up the baby. That was a given. That was a fact of life. But I ordered a Captain and Coke just for the smell of it. I was on my second, or maybe my third, when the place began to fill up. And I realized, with a stab of happiness, that this must have been an after-work hangout, with a prescribed happy hour and some sort of comestibles served up gratis on a heated tray. I'd been wrapped up in my grief. a grief that was all for myself, for the fact that I was 26 years old and going nowhere, with a baby to take care of and a wife in the process of flogging a law degree and changing her name because she wasn't who she used to be. And now suddenly I'd come awake. There were women everywhere. Women my age and older, leaning into the bar with their earrings swaying, lined up at the door, sitting at tables, legs crossed, feet tapping rhythmically to the canned music. Me? I had to pick up the baby. I checked my watch and saw that I was already late, late for the second day running. But I was hungry all of a sudden, and I thought I'd just maybe have a couple of the taquitos everybody was shoving into their mouths while I finished my drink. And then I'd get in the car, take the back streets to Violetta's, and be home just before my wife and see if we could get another meal out of the marinara sauce with porcini mushrooms and turkey sausage. That was when I felt a pressure on my arm, my left arm, and I lifted my chin to glance over my shoulder into the face of Joel Chinowski, who occupied the bay next to mine at Iron House Productions. At first, I didn't recognize him, one of those tricks of the mind, the inebriated mind especially, in which you can't place people out of context, though you know them absolutely. "Joel," I said. He was shaking his head very slowly, as if he were tolling a bell, as if his eyes were the clappers and his skull the ringing shell of it. He had a big head, huge. He was big all around, one of those people who aren't obese, or not exactly, but just overgrown to the extent that his clothes seemed inflated, his pants, his jacket, even his socks. He was wearing a tie, the only one of the 76 employees at Iron House to dress in shirt and tie, and it looked like a toy trailing away from his supersized collar. "Oh, shit, man," he said, squeezing tighter. "Shit." "Yeah," I said, and my head was tolling too. I felt caught out, felt like the very essence he was naming, like shit, that is. "We all heard," he said. He removed his hand from my arm, peered into his palm as if trying to divine what to say next. "Oh, it sucks," he said. "It really sucks." "Yeah," I said. And then, though his face never changed expression, he seemed to brighten around the eyes for a moment. "Hey," he said, "look, can I buy you a drink? I mean, to drown the sorrow. I mean, that's what you're doing, right? And I don't blame you, not at all. If it was me..." He let the thought trail off. There was a girl, two stools down from me. Her hair pulled up in a long, trailing ponytail, and she was wearing a knit jumper over a little black skirt and red leggings. She glanced up at me, two green, swimming eyes above a pair of lips pursed at the straw of her drink. "Or maybe," Joel said, "you'd rather be alone?" I dragged my eyes away from the girl. "I really appreciate it, but, like, I'm meeting Clover at, well, the funeral parlor. You know, to make the arrangements. And it's, I just stopped in for a drink, that's all." "Oh, man." Joel was practically erupting from his shoes, his face drawn down like a curtain, and every blood vessel in his eyes gone to waste. "I understand. I understand completely." On the way out the door, I flipped open my cell and dialed Violetta to tell her my wife would be picking up the baby tonight because I was working late. And then I left a message to the same effect at my wife's law office. Then I went looking for a bar where I could find something to eat and maybe one last drink before I went home to lie some more. The next day, Friday, I didn't even bother to call in, but I was feeling marginally better. I had a mild hangover, my head still clanging dully, and my stomach shriveled up around a little nugget of nothing, so that after I dropped the baby off, I wasn't able to take anything more than dry toast and black coffee at the diner that was fast becoming my second home. And yet the force of the lie, the enormity of it, was behind me. And here, outside the windows, the sun was shining for the first time in days. I'd been listening to the surf report on the car on the way over. We were getting 6-foot swells as a result of the storm. And after breakfast, I dug out my wetsuit and board and let the Pacific roll on under me until I forgot everything in the world but the taste of salt and the smell of the breeze and the weird, strangled cries of the gulls. I was home by 3, and I vacuumed, washed the dishes, scrubbed the counters. I was 20 minutes early to pick up Santa, and while dinner was cooking, meatloaf with boiled potatoes in their skins and asparagus vinaigrette, I took her to the park and listened to her screech with baby joy as I held her in my lap and rocked higher and higher on the swings. When Clover came home, she was too tired to fight, and she accepted the meatloaf and the wine I'd picked up as the peace offerings they were, and after the baby was asleep, we listened to music, smoked a joint, and made love in a slow, deep plunge that was like paddling out on a wave of flesh for what seemed like hours. We took a drive up the coast on Saturday, And on Sunday afternoon, we went over to Tank's for lunch and saw how sad his apartment was, with its brick and board bookcases, the faded band posters curling away from the walls, and the deep pile rug that was once off-white and was now just plain dirty. In the car on the way home, Clover said she never could understand people who treated their dog as if they'd given birth to it, and I shook my head, tolling it now, but easily, thankfully, and said, I couldn't agree more. I woke on Monday before the alarm went off, and I was showered and shaved and in the car before my wife left for work, and when I pulled up in front of the long, windowless, gray stucco edifice that housed Iron House Productions, I was so early, Radko himself hadn't showed up yet. I took off my watch and stuffed it deep in my pocket, letting the monotony of work drag me down till I was conscious of nothing, not my fingers at the keyboard or the image on the screen or the dialogue I was capturing frame by frozen frame. Log and capture, that was what I was doing, hour, minute, second, frame, transcribing everything that had been shot so the film's editor could locate what he wanted without going through the soul-crushing drudgery of transcribing it himself. At some point, it might have been an hour in, 2 hours, I don't know, I became aware of the intense, gland-clenching aroma of vanilla chai, hot, spiced, blended, the very thing I wanted, caffeine to drive a stake into the boredom. Vanilla chai, available at the coffee house down the street, but a real indulgence because of the cost. Usually I made do with the acidic black coffee and artificial creamer Radko provided on a stained cart set up against the back wall. I lifted my head to search out the aroma, and there was Jeannie, the secretary from the front office, holding a paperboard venti in one hand and a platter of what turned out to be homemade cannoli in the other. What? I said, thinking Radko had sent her to tell me he wanted to see me in his office. But she didn't say anything for a long, excruciating moment, her eyes full, her face white as a mask. And then she shoved the chai into my hand and set the tray down on the desk beside me. I am so sorry for your loss, she said. And then I felt her hand on my shoulder, and she was dipping forward in a typhoon of perfume to plant a lugubrious kiss just beneath my left ear. What can I say? I felt bad about the whole business, felt low and despicable. But I cracked the plastic lid and sipped the chai, and as if I weren't even conscious of what my fingers were doing, I started in on the cannoli, one by one, till the platter was bare. I was just sucking the last of the sugar from my fingertips when Steve Bartholomew, a guy of 30 or so who worked in special effects, a guy I barely knew, came up to me and without a word pressed a tin of butter cookies into my hand. Hey, I said, addressing his retreating shoulders. Thanks, man, thanks. It means a lot. By noon, my desk was piled high with foodstuffs, sandwiches, sweets, a dry salami as long as my forearm, and at least a dozen gray-jacketed sympathy cards inscribed by one coworker or another. I wanted to hide, wanted to quit, wanted to go home, tear the phone out of the wall, get into bed and never leave. But I didn't. I just sat there, trying to work, giving one person after another a zombie smile and my best impression of the 1,000-yard stare. Just before quitting time, Radko appeared, his face like an old paper bag left out in the rain. He was flanked by Joel Chernowski. I glanced up at them out of wary eyes, and in a flash of intuition, I realized how much I hated them both, how much I wanted only to jump to my feet like a cornered animal and punch them out, both of them. Radko said nothing. He just stood there, gazing down at me, and then after a moment, he pressed one hand to my shoulder in Slavic commiseration, turned and walked away. Listen, man, Joel said, shifting his eyes away from mine. We all wanted to, well, we got together, me and some of the others, and I know that isn't much, but I saw now that he was holding a plastic grocery sack in one hand. I knew what was in the sack. I tried to wave it away, but he thrust it at me, and I had no choice but to take it. Later, when I got home and the baby was in her high chair smearing her face with cream of wheat and I'd slipped the microwave pizza out of its box, I sat down and emptied the contents of the bag on the kitchen table. It was mainly cash, but there were maybe a half a dozen checks, too. I saw one for $25, another for $50. The baby made one of those expressions of baby joy, sharp and sudden, as if the impulse had seized her before she could process it. It was 5:30, and the sinking sun was pasted over the windows. I sifted the bills through my hands, tens, twenties, fives, a lot of fives, and surprisingly few singles, thinking how generous my co-workers were, how good and real and giving. But I was grieving all the same, grieving beyond any measure I could ever have imagined or contained. I was in the process of counting the money, thinking I'd give it back or donate it to some charity, when I heard Clover's key in the lock And I swept it all back into the bag and tucked that bag in the deep recess under the sink where the water persistently dripped from the crusted over pipe and the old sponge there smelled of mold. The minute my wife left the next morning, I called Radko and told him I wasn't coming in. He didn't ask for an excuse, but I gave him one anyway. The funeral, I said. It's at 11 a.m., just family, very private. My wife's taking it hard. He made some sort of noise on the other end of the line, a sigh, a belch, the faintest cracking of his knuckles. Tomorrow, I said, I'll be in tomorrow without fail. And then the day began. But it wasn't like that first day, not at all. I didn't feel giddy, didn't feel liberated, or even relieved. All I felt was regret and the cold drop of doom. I deposited the baby at Violetta's and went straight home to bed, wanting only to clear some space for myself and think things out. There was no way I could return the money. I wasn't that good an actor. And I couldn't spend it either, even to make up for the loss of pay. That would have been low, lower than anything I'd ever done in my life. I thought of Clover then, how furious she'd be when she found out my pay had been docked. If it had been docked, there was still a chance Radko would let it slide, given the magnitude of my tragedy, a chance that he was human after all, a good chance. No, the only thing to do was bury the money someplace. I'd burn the checks first. I couldn't run the risk of anybody uncovering them. That would be a real disaster, magnitude 10. Nobody could explain that. Though various scenarios were already suggesting themselves. A thief had stolen the bag from the glove box of my car. It had blown out the window on the freeway while I was on my way to the mortuary. The neighbor's pet macaque had come in through the open window and made off with it, wadding the checks and chewing up the money till it was just monkey feces now. Monkey feces. Monkey feces. I found myself repeating the phrase over and over as if it were a prayer. It was a little past 9 when I had my first beer. And for the rest of the day, till I had to pick up the baby, I never moved from the couch. I tried to gauge Clover's mood when she came in the door, dressed like a lawyer, in her gray herringbone jacket and matching skirt, her hair pinned up and her eyes in traffic mode. The place was a mess. I hadn't picked up, hadn't put on anything for dinner. The baby, asleep in her molded plastic carrier, gave off a stink you could smell across the room. I looked up from my beer. I thought we'd go out tonight, I told her. My treat. And then, because I couldn't help myself, I added, I'm just trashed from work. She wasn't happy about it. I could see that lawyerly calculations transfiguring her face as she weighed the hassle of running up the boulevard with her husband and baby in tow before leaving for her 8 o'clock class. I watched her reach back to remove the clip from her hair and shake it loose. I guess, she said, but no Italian. She set down her briefcase in the entry hall where the phone was. And she put a thumb in her mouth a moment, a habit of hers. She was a fingernail chewer. Before she said, well, what about Chinese? She shrugged before I could. As long as it's quick, I don't really care. I was about to agree with her, about to rise up out of the grip of the couch and do my best to minister to the baby and get us out the door en famille, when the phone rang. Clover answered. Hello? This is she. My right knee cracked as I stood, a reminder of the torn ACL I'd suffered in high school when I'd made the slightest miscalculation regarding the drop off the backside of a boulder while snowboarding at Mammoth. Jeannie, my wife said, her eyebrows lifting in two perfect arches. Yes, she said. Oh, yes, Jeannie, how are you? There was a long pause as Jeannie said what she was going to say. And then my wife said, oh, no, there must be some mistake. The baby's fine. She's right here in her carrier, fast asleep. And her voice grew heartier, surprise and confusion riding the cusp of the joke. She could use a fresh diaper, judging from the smell of her, but that's her daddy's job, or it's going to be, if we ever expect to. And then there was another pause, longer this time. And I watched my wife's gaze shift from the form of the sleeping baby in her terry cloth jumpsuit to where I was standing beside the couch. Her eyes, in soft focus for the baby, hardened as they climbed from my shoe tops to my face where they rested like two balls of granite. Anybody would have melted under that kind of scrutiny. My wife, the lawyer. It would be a long night, I could see that. There would be no Chinese, no food of any kind. I found myself denying everything, telling her how scattered Jeannie was and how she must have mixed us up with the Lovetts. Remember Tony Lovett worked in SFX? Yeah, they just lost their baby, a little girl. Yeah, no, it was awful. I told her we'd all chipped in. Me too, I put in a 50, and that was excessive, I know it. But I felt I had to, you know, because of the baby, because what if it happened to us? I went on in that vein till I ran out of breath, and when I tried to be nonchalant about it and go to the refrigerator for another beer, She blocked my way. "Where's the money?" she said. We were 2 feet apart. I didn't like the look she was giving me because it spared nothing. I could have kept it up, could have said, "What money?" injecting all the trampled innocence I could summon into my voice, but I didn't. I merely bent to the cabinet under the sink, extracted the white plastic bag, and handed it to her. She took it as if it were the bleeding corpse of our daughter, or no, of our relationship that went back 3 years to the time when I was up on stage, gilded in light, my message elided under the hammer of the guitar and the thump of the bass. She didn't look inside. She just held my eyes. "You know this is fraud, don't you?" she said. "A felony offense? They can lock you up for this. You know that?" She wasn't asking a question. She was making a demand. And I wasn't about to answer. Because the baby was dead, and she was dead too. Radko is dead, Jeannie the secretary, whose last name I didn't even know, and Joel Chinowski and all the rest of them. Very slowly, button by button, I did up my shirt. Then I set my empty beer bottle down on the counter as carefully as if it were full to the lip, and went on out the door and into the night, looking for somebody I could tell all about it. Thank you. So, now I've already, you know, complimented you on your physical beauty. Now I have to compliment you on being a terrific audience. You make it so easy for me. It's tremendous fun. I really enjoyed that. And now I'm going to wander and we'll do some Q&A. And I can already anticipate the first question. And the answer is West Hollywood. Come on, folks. Don't be shy. I'll be back someday. Yes? How do I pronounce my middle name? That's simple. Karagason. The Brits were the first to edit my name to TC because they felt it was too aggressively Irish for their constituency, and that's at least 25 years ago. Everyone else has followed suit, including we, beautiful Americans, and I'm perfectly happy to be TC. But you know, a name like Karagason, you know. I was pretty sure I was the only one. But then, some years ago, a couple came up to me afterward, and the woman was very visibly pregnant, and they said, boy or girl, they were going to name him or her Karagason. I said, please, spare the child. And there she is in the back row tonight. No, I don't know. I don't know if that, I hope it, they named her Emma. So, yes. Hold on. She'll give you the microphone.
A loud voice, but okay. So in the story that you just shared with us, your main character, did you feel more sympathy or disgust or what? I'm just thinking, you know, yeah. How'd you feel about this guy?
I am a staid and retiring college professor, and I would have nothing to do with any person like this, you know. I don't know. All of my stories and all of my novels just begin. I don't know where it will go, what it will mean, what it is. That's why I love to do it. I discover it as I go along. And I do feel attraction to this sort of character, the kind of unregenerate punk, you know, who is also self-deluding in some ways. And I think, you know, it's not for me to write the thesis on my own work, but I think you'll find this sort of character popping up in some of my other things. I think probably the genesis was maybe the characters in Greasy Lake, and then a little later, Walter Van Brunt of World's End. And it is an attractive sort of character for me. But I like to try to inhabit anybody and any kind of character, so that the story I was telling you about in The New Yorker last week, a death in Kitchewank, is told from the point of view of a middle-aged woman. You know, and I just wrote a new story, also told from the point of view of a woman. So I like to take on any challenge and write about anything. My proudest moment in this regard, point of view, was in a story called Big Game some years ago, in which I was able for a couple of paragraphs to inhabit the brain of an old circus elephant named Bessie B, who just wasn't going to take it anymore. Yeah, you know when elephants really get mad at you and they've already stomped on you a couple of times, they rub their head into you and rub you into the pavement with their heads. Yeah. I know that I was a mahout in India for 22 years. I know all about elephants. Yeah. Spare them the ankus, boy. So, other questions? Yes.
Do you think the role of a good satirist is to take a moral position for a protagonist, or do you think a good satirist stays out of the story?
That's a great question. I think choice B. Choice B. I think you have to let the audience decide for themselves. I don't think you can push anything on anybody. That said, a satire, one of my heroes, Evelyn Waugh, has its limitation in that it only makes fun of things. And that could suggest corrective behavior. We're superior to this. We're superior to this guy here. You know, we wouldn't want to be like him. But you can't really push that on the audience. The audience has to decide for themselves. And I'm sure at least, a good third of this audience admires the guy in that story and wants to be just like him. Thanks. So, anything else? Yes.
I noticed you were really specific about food in that, and then also wine, like we know it was Chianti, but you didn't say what kind of beer he was drinking, and he drinks a lot of it, so I'm curious.
Well, we know that as we've all graduated into becoming foodies now, not me so much, beer is passé, you know, we need to have a nice wine, and we need to cook for our wives, we really do. You know, people presume that I'm a gourmet because I wrote Sorry Fugu about the gourmet chef. You know, I love good food, and I've been to many good restaurants around the world, and it's a wonderful thing. But, I have some friends who really obsess over this thing, and their whole social life revolves around knowing so-and-so the chef and being whisked in the back door and so on. It's all right, but it's not my kind of thing. By the way, a great tragedy in my life. Since 1985 until 2 years ago, I ate at the finest restaurant in the world every time I went to USC. I'm referring to the University Sizzler, of course. And in May of 2008, on the day of my last class, I went over for lunch, and there was a little sign on the door, the Sizzler is closed. Why is the Sizzler closed? What does this mean? Well, it's closed permanently, and now I have to go to the faculty club. And, you know, it's all right, but the problem with that is the faculty is there. We had a question over here. Yes.
Do you have a particular place that you always write in, or can you write anywhere?
Well, I can write anywhere, but, you know, I like to be sitting at a desk and have a computer and a little keyboard. I never write anything by hand. I never have. I always composed on a keyboard. I hope none of my students are listening, because I won't let you do this. But I wasn't such a great student, and my papers were late, so I didn't have time to write them in hand. I had to type them out and hope for the best. So I've always worked on a keyboard, so I do need that. I spent a lot of time in the Sequoia National Forest. I rent a house up there, and a couple of months a year. I like to begin and end books there because it's so incredibly boring. You know, you just work harder every day. And also, you're away from all the problems of normal life, so that instead of hassling with the world when you're done with work, you know, you walk in the woods with your dog and a book, and, you know, and you have childlike wonder over the beauties of nature and so on. And this is very important to me. And so I do work a lot up there. And again, I need the focus to begin and end. But again, I could do it anywhere. When my children were very little, I would just shut the bedroom door and turn the music up really loud. Their mother was home with them, and they understood that, you know, Daddy was in there working, and I was very rarely disturbed. I've always had the peace and time to do what I need to do. Yes.
When you come up with these brilliant phrases, like a dagger through the day's boredom, you know, the cup of coffee being in, do you think these things up, or do you collect them throughout?
By the way, we're paying this woman $500 to ask these questions. Thank you so much. No, everything has to happen organically. It just happens. You can't save phrases. You can't write one scene and substitute it for another because you're bored at that moment. I am very rigid, and I must go through every story. I only work on one thing at a time, and no matter how difficult it is or what trouble I run into, it has to proceed organically. I don't know any other way to work, and I think it's artificial to work in another way. Everybody's different, of course. If I were one of these authors who, you know, writes the kitchen scene because he feels like it and somehow that'll fit in eventually, I'd be in the sub-basement of the mental hospital wrapped in chains. I just couldn't do it. You know, it has to proceed. You can't save phrases and stick them in. It just has to happen. I don't know how better to explain it. Yes.
Hi, you said that you don't know where a novel is going to end when you start it necessarily. I'm wondering if you have ever started a novel and decided that it's not going anywhere and abandoned it. And if so, how far is the farthest in you've gotten, and how did you know that it wasn't going to work?
The answer is no. No, thank God. No, absolutely not. I have, especially when I was first starting to write, I have written, started stories and got halfway through and given up on them. And I wrote a lot of apprentice stories, which I published but never collected, which I just didn't think were that great eventually, you know, or not as good as the best I could do. But as I quickly learned, you don't want to invest your time in something that's not going to work. So I would know within a paragraph or a page and abandon something. It's odd. Every time I start a story, or any of it, I can see that probably 90% of you are writers too. I know that already. Anytime we start a story, you know, it's very tentative. You don't know what it is. And the first lines and the first paragraph or so might be there for you, and they might not. And it might take me several days to write a page even, to get it going, and your unconscious mind works on this while you're walking the dog on the beach or whatever you're doing. I spend a lot of time digging holes and filling them back in again. I'm great at that, you know. And I think it takes some gestation. But it is an investment, and you have to... You're very tentative at first until it starts to happen. And, you know, like with the story you just heard, you have to, sometimes a voice starts to talk to you, and you have to follow it and see who it is and what it's going to be. It's the joy of doing it that you don't know, which again is why I don't, you know, never wanted to be a man of letters. I don't want to give speeches or write essays. I don't want to work in Hollywood. I only want to do what I'm doing because it's so amazing. I mean, I want to see what's coming next. Yes.
Well, I've only read three of your books, but I was interested tonight when you had a character named Radko, because I just finished reading Talk Talk, and you had a Radko, Serbian Radko, who fit the exact description. So I just wondered if you move your characters around quite a bit, or if that's just a rare occasion.
Well, thanks for the question. I, by the way, have read all 22 of my books, and I love them. I really love them. That's a great observation. I do like to have sly little in-jokes like that so that Radko reappears, and I think if you know my work well, you'll see that some characters will reappear. Not in the way of a sequel, but just for the fun of having the dedicated readers make those connections. Tony Lovett was a former student of mine whom I love dearly, and I just love his name. And so he popped up in Greasy Lake, probably my most anthologized story, and I had to give him a little return in this story, too, just for the fun of it. Just a few more before we hang it up. How are we doing on time? 5 minutes more or so? Yeah, okay. Yes?
What was the inspiration for the women?
Well, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright fits into a certain thing I've been doing with historical novels that have actual people in them. I like to call them the great egomaniacs of the 20th century. In fact, my editor says we'll do a boxed set. So we begin with John Harvey Kellogg of The Road to Wellville, and then Alfred C. Kinsey, of course, as you know, invented sex in the inner circle, and now Frank Lloyd Wright. They are all dynamic figures of the progressive era who felt, narcissists, who felt that their projects were so important that they needed followers to devote themselves to that project. And there was absolute rigidity with this, and this is the way it had to be. And I always wonder what is the effect on the people around them. If you give yourself over to somebody else, well, what are you making of your own life, you know? And so this is sort of what I've been exploring with these characters. So he was within sight of me, but then my wife and I moved into this house when we made our escape from L.A. a few years back, and it was his first California house. And it was looking pretty good. All that redwood is original, but it needed a lot of work. It was listing to the east. It needed foundations poured and so on and so on. And so ever since then, I had thought it would be interesting to explore his life and also interesting to learn more about him since I'm living in the house. However, you know, you are moved to do things in a different order, and I wound up writing 10 other books in that house before I wrote this one. But those are the two principal reasons why I wanted to explore him. So how about two more questions, and we'll hang it up. Yes, sir, right here.
I've noticed a couple, or more than a couple, of references to birds and avian behavior in your writing. Do you have a special interest in that subject?
Yeah, I'm a nature boy. I love nature. I do spend a lot of time by myself, deep in the sequoia forest. I mean, I love to get away and just have a kind of pure experience where you don't really, you're like a child, you don't really think of the specific name of the bird or the tree or anything else. You just see things, you know? I love that. And I do love biology and biologists. This new book, When the Killing's Done, is about the ecological restoration out there on the Channel Islands. I thought, boy, if I could only talk to a biologist. But wow, it was so much better. I got to go with the fox lady. It's like joining the Marine Corps, by the way. 5 a.m. up and down these hills with the little foxes and the traps. But it was a great experience. I write more and more about the environment and about nature. I'm just endlessly fascinated with it. And, of course, that includes the birds as well. Although I have to say my favorite animal is the hyena. And the final question is from this lady over here. Yes.
I remember when I read Tortilla Flats, it's as a school teacher, it stayed with me for a long, long time and kept popping back up. Where were you in your life? Because I really can't believe that you started that story and let it take you where you went.
Well, thank you. About the tortilla curtain, you know, here's my life story in short. I grew up in New York. I had never been west of the Hudson River till I was in my early 20s. And then I went all the way west to Buffalo because I married a Buffalo gal. And then we went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and then USC gave me a job. We came to L.A. and lived here. That's it. That's the whole story. So even though I'm a Californian now and I ain't going back, and I love it here, I still see things slightly differently from native Californians. And I think that sort of fish out of water thing is interesting and productive for my work. And so one of the first books about California that I wrote was The Tortilla Curtain. And this was written in 93 and 94 when the debate was raging over Prop 187 and all of that. And every day in the paper in the LA Times, it was yes and no and back and forth. And I just wanted to explore the issue for my own purposes. And this is why, the question about morals and satire and so on comes up. I'm just doing it for my own benefit, to make a work of art out of something. As I've said, I'm not going around all day thinking lofty thoughts. I really don't think very, very deeply unless I am writing a story. That's how I focus myself. You know, basically, you see me walking around and I'm exactly the same as you, thinking exactly the same thought. Kill, screw, eat. Kill, screw, eat. That's how we exist. That's who we are. So, that said, I hope you enjoyed the evening. And I'll see you again. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.